गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय ददालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद भक्ताय नमो नमः। So, pranam to all of you. Greetings from Sri Ananda Ashram, North Carolina, United States. Here we are again, one more week. Sorry, last week was not able to connect by due to this toothache that came and still has to be fixed in a few days. We'll go to the dentist and life happens. And we will be staying one more week here and then traveling to New Mexico for a few days, not so much, less than a week, to visit Father Richard Rohr and other friends, Brian McLaren, very interesting Christian mystics, authors, friends. So that will be looking forward to that experience for sure. There's a retreat there those days that I've been invited to be part of. And then I'll go into Arkansas for a few days, a little bit more than a week for another retreat, and then back to North Carolina, and so on and so forth. And I hope you had a very profound celebration of Sri Gaur Purnim. It was last Sunday. So we had a very nice meeting here. We had this meeting. I had the second meeting in Spanish with the South American devotees. So it was a double session of trying to to imbibe Mahaprabhu, no, in my life, to make sense, so to say, in my heart, not in my head, to make sense of all that, not all, but a point of that all that Mahaprabhu represents. So it was a big internally, not necessarily externally, but big internally. That's the important thing of the event, and it remains big internally. It remains significant and with a lot of repercussions, so to say, whether externally there's an audience or not. So anyhow, a few words regarding how these days have been going on. I'm not seeing any raised hand yet. So of course you are, all of you. Most of you have already joined, all of you probably before, but in case you're joining now, you can raise your hand through Zoom physically in one way or another, and you're invited to present questions or comments or things you may like that we try to elaborate in this Ishtagoshti, in this sharing of hearts, basically. So I'm seeing a few hands raised. So they appear in order, if I'm not mistaken. So the first one is from Ruchir Polani. So Ruchir, please, if you can unmute yourself.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Maharaj, and all others present here. I want to ask about the stories in Bhagavatam that we read, and also about Mahaprabhu. Like, it happened only 500 years ago. That is what we read and listen. So how do we make sense of it, that all of this is real? Because when we see any television or movies or anything in this life, when we hear somebody's story, so we feel emotionally connected to that, and we feel sad about it or happy about it, and we have emotions flowing through those stories of anybody's pains and happiness and everything. So how do we make sense that what we are listening and hearing about the devotees of Krishna, and so is that real? And because that I'm having trouble to understand that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the question, and thank you for having the courage of saying something like, I'm having trouble to understand that. Because sometimes we may not dare to express our difficulty in grasping some of the things, or even in believing that this is true. No? Sometimes we may just take everything for granted and subscribe to the, so to say, the legal beliefs I'm supposed to have as a Gaudiya Vaishnav. Sometimes we may misread. Participating in a mystical tradition means adopting the correct beliefs, and then I impart. If I say what I'm supposed to say, if I don't say what I'm not supposed to say, if I believe what I'm supposed to believe, even though I don't have any experience or substantial faith, epiphany, revelation, but I just subscribe to the legal beliefs. But that's not the idea. So the idea is that we have faith. Faith is grounded in experience, not in like a mental conviction. I'm like, yeah, I will like to think this is like that. So of course this is a big topic beyond your question, but in the sense of, okay, we are all here practicing or trying to practice somehow or other Krishna bhakti, Krishna consciousness. So what has been our experience of that? How much we have directly experienced that this is real, that Krishna exists? I mean, I'm not questioning here the validity of the process. I'm just inviting all of us to question the place from which we are participating, and hopefully we are not doing so from a place of dogma, from a place of imposed social pressure, or again, embrace the right beliefs and you are in. Because again, we can believe so many things, but the real thing is to have an experience of those things. Or at least, again, because of course you may tell me, well, Maharaj, I have not a direct experience of the existence of Prahlad Maharaj. I have not had the darshan of, I don't know, Mahadev. I have not have a dialogue with Pundarik Vidyanidhi. So how do I know that all of them are real and exist? Until and unless I have an epiphany with each one of them, only then I can really have true faith. Now, I'm not saying that. But at least we should have some type of experience that connects us with those personalities. Not like to give an example, okay, Mahaprabhu, going to your question, Mahaprabhu. I mean, in one sense, with Mahaprabhu, the case is easier than with Krishna, I will say, in terms of Mahaprabhu is a historical provable figure, so to say. No, I mean, in general, you cannot establish so much how much you can prove the existence of a figure 5,000 years ago or thousands of years ago. But with someone from 500 years ago, there are other methods that we can resort to that clearly establish this person was real, existed, and there is like different testimonies of different people who met him and those connected with this and those connected with this. And of course, then we have the idea of parampara. And that's ultimately how we can prove God's existence, no? In one sense, that person is real or existed is by contacting someone who contacted someone who contacted someone and so on and so forth. And by contacting that person in the here and now, we are having an experience. Now, at the end of the day, Sanatan Goswami makes this point, which is very interesting, because he says pratyaksha is the ultimate praman. He mentions that in his commentary on Brihadbhagavatamrita, which seems to be pratyaksha. I clarify the term. Pratyaksha means personal direct experience. So he says personal direct experience is the ultimate form of praman. Praman means like evidence in terms of epistemology, how we know what we know. So the ultimate way of ascertaining what is what is your personal experience. And so what's the mean? This seems to contradict what Jiva Goswami says in the Tattvasandarbha when he says the ultimate pramana is shabda, no? Or revealed knowledge. But there is no contradiction actually, because the point is that what's shabda, there are different ways to explain this. In one sense, what shabda revealed knowledge is the personal experience that an enlightened person had. For example, for us, Srimad Bhagavatam is Shabda, right? Srimad Bhagavatam is Shabda. But what's Srimad Bhagavatam? Srimad Bhagavatam is the Samadhi of Vyasadeva. That's described in the Bhagavatam itself. Samadhi Bhasha. The Bhagavatam is written in Samadhi Bhasha, in the language of Samadhi, as we mentioned many times. So the Bhagavatam is nothing but the pratyaksha or personal direct experience of an enlightened person like Vyasadeva, and that becomes Shabda. So in that sense, you can say the ultimate authority is Shabda, but Shabda is the pratyaksha of someone. And that will be the Vaidusha pratyaksha in the terms of Jiva Goswami. Vaidusha pratyaksha means the personal experience of someone basically enlightened with knowledge. We have Vaidusha and Avaidusha pratyaksha. Avaidusha means sense, personal experience of a conditioned soul. That's not the ultimate way of ascertaining the nature of reality. But if someone is enlightened beyond the influence of this world, so to say, that becomes Shabda. That experience becomes Shabda. And at the end of the day, also we could say that personal experience is the ultimate pramana or evidence, because at the end of the day, it all depends on what we are experiencing. Even if I put myself in front of revealed knowledge, Shastra, a saintly person, it all boils down to what was my experience of that. If I had no experience of that, I won't be embracing that. So, of course, we may need to put ourselves in front of those portals to have an experience. But if we wouldn't have any experience, probably we wouldn't continue proceeding in that direction. So in that sense, at the end of the day, pratyaksha, personal experience, is the ultimate yardstick, so to say. So in relation to Mahaprabhu, again, how do we know it's difficult to make sense of his existence and so on? He existed. He's a historical figure. That's, I mean, even if you want, if we wouldn't be talking among practitioners, but just about among scholars who are just researching objectively the life of Sri Chaitanya without any bias, without any faith, without any anything, just purely objective facts and research. there is no argument among the many scholars who have done that research on Sri Chaitanya. There are many who are not Gaudiya Vaishnavas, and none of them are coming with arguments like he actually didn't exist, that figure is not real, because there is so much input from different sources, from different witnesses who lived with Mahaprabhu and wrote about his life, his symptoms, of course, his heart, his example. We have so many biographies, hagiographies of Mahaprabhu. And again, all that those witnesses have gathered and experienced have been passed on through parampara. So I will say that the ultimate way of making sense of the reality of Mahaprabhu is, besides this technical point that he's an historical, provable, figurable figure, is for us to expose ourselves to different personalities in whose heart Mahaprabhu is truly alive, and who will give us an experience of his reality and his existence. That's how it works. No, I remember Srila Siddha Maharaj will say famously, when he went, one of the first times he went to visit Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was not yet living in the math. He was not yet initiated by his Gurudev, but he was going first days to have darshan and listen from him. So he realized that this was before the big Bagh Bazar Gaudiya Math in Kolkata. So they were living in a rented house. And on the ground floor was the temple room, a small temple room, and Mahaprabhu, there was a deity of Mahaprabhu in the altar. And on the first floor, on top of the ground floor, was Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta's room. So Srila Siddha Maharaj was curious, and he asked, like, why the room of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is above the altar? Why he's on top of Mahaprabhu, so to say? He was curious. And he inquired this from some of the local devotees, and he mentioned that the devotees say, no, it's not like this. On the ground floor is Mahaprabhu in the altar, and on the top floor is Mahaprabhu in the heart of our Gurudev. And the Mahaprabhu in the heart of our Gurudev is more real than the Mahaprabhu in the altar. He made that point at the end. Like implying the way Mahaprabhu will play out through the heart of a realized sadhu, that's the most real direct experience. So yeah. Again, on one side we have the technical aspect, the biographical thing, the more heady stuff, okay, how to prove Mahaprabhu's existence objectively. Okay, we have resources and we can do our research and that's there. But then comes the more subjective, personal, faith-like internal experience, and that will come through us. Of course, we can study the books that those witnesses of Mahaprabhu's life are writing. Those in themselves will give us an experience, and those are coming through Parampara. But I will recommend, in complement to that, yeah, the openness to connect with sadhus for whom Sri Chaitanya Devi is the most real of the real. And then, if we are open, that will naturally convey to us an experience of that reality. We may not have the experience that they are having, but we will have an experience of being close to their experience. That's in itself an experience, and to itself, that's a big experience. Now, you may get closer to, let's say, an pure devotee, and by being close to them or him or her, you may not get the exact same pure devotee experience they are having, but you will have the experience of being close to the experience of a pure devotee, which may be fair enough for the day, so to say. So somehow or other, it's important that we try to remain in the proximity of people that we feel that they are sincere. And again, because in the beginning we may not be able to, with a yardstick, okay, who is pure devotee, who is this, who is that, but be open, pray sincerely, and trust that Krishna will send to your life, to our life, the company and the association of deep, honest practitioners. And by their association, by hearing their katha and their connection, gradually, it doesn't have to happen in a moment, but gradually we will get one experience after another about Mahaprabhu or whatever, anything. And those experiences will really be what will become the bedrock for our faith. Because again, faith is trust in experience. I have a certain experience, and this gives me certain trust and confidence on the basis of that experience, which is not the same as just believing about something. So we don't want to create a cult, a dogma, where people just swallow beliefs without being convinced about them, without understanding why they believe what they believe. But we want deep personal experiences. So that will be my answer, Ruchir, today. So I hope that helps. Thank you for your question. Mahaprabhu ki jai.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So there are a few other raised hands. Next one is Rasangi. So please, you can unmute yourself.
Hare Bol Maharaj. Pranams to you, and I'm happy you're well enough to be with us today.
Yeah, that's the description. Well enough to give the class today. That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah, happy about that. I'm still on individuation in your book, and I just love it. It's like a mind-blowing. I'm talking about Naralila translating as human-like divine play. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, you know, what that means, because I've read it over and over again, and I kind of don't exactly get it. But the other thing is, what I really want to know too is, what do we take with us? You know, you talk about the empiric experience, empiric individual jiva.
The empiric individual jiva?
Well, you say here that as we, it says, we, when we become more, when we join the Naralila, we bring certain parts of ourselves with us. I mean, I always thought we have a whole entire different personality. Everything is different. But what you're saying in the book is that there's certain parts of us that stay with us and travel and become part of that Naralila.
Okay.
So that's
What
kind of what I'd love to hear more about.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that I think that's kind of complementary to a question that I remember Sumati did make some weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago or a month ago, and in relation to the one's body. And body becomes spiritualized, and what happens with that body? Are we entering into the lila and the spiritual world with the self-same body that becomes fully spiritualized, or what? So we clarify a little bit that. So now your question goes a little bit more to the, if I'm understanding properly, more connected to the, well, we could say the psychic body, not so much the physical body, but the psychic body, our personality, traits in this lifetime, and how much they can become exported into the lila, so to say, and so on. So, and of course, first of all, you mentioned about the Nar Lila, and if we can say a few words in that connection. So yeah, Nar Lila means, Nara, technically speaking, means human. Although sometimes, as we know, Prabhupada translated that as human-like, and I'm totally fine with that, and I try to make sense of that in my book and think of that. But actually, Nara Lila means human Lila. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes in the Raghavatma Chandrika that Nara Lila is a Lila where, even if some Aishwarya is exhibited, the experience of humanness is never transgressed. So the human sense, the human experience for all the parts involved is never transgressed. It's always in the forefront. So fully human, no? As I like to mention in the book, Nara Lila is fully human, fully divine. That's how I understand Prabhupada saying human-like. No, human-like doesn't mean half-baked humanity. The like in human-like doesn't mean pseudo-humanity. No, inhuman, quasi-human, inhuman, what to speak. No, no. For me, the human-like means human, fully human, and the like means fully divine. Because it still is fully divine. No, Krishna Lila is fully divine, but it's fully human. And of course, for our dualistic minds, that's a contradiction. No, how can something be fully divine and fully human? It's not possible. We will say that from our mind place. So that's why mantra, manastrayate, you have to transcend your mind to understand this type of things. We have to learn to think about reality in a different way, basically. To enter into more spacious vision where things that on some level are paradoxical and contradictory are no longer such from a broader perspective. So Golok Vrindavan is the broadest perspective possible, and there are all these extreme, so to say, apparent opposites coexist in peace and are fully reconciled. So Nara Lila is that, the perfect integration of full divinity, full Aishwarya, full opulence, as we say always. In Vrindavan, you will find more Aishwarya than anywhere else. Even in comparison with Vaikuntha, the Aishwarya of Vrindavan is extreme. In Vrindavan, the land itself, the dust, each speck of dust is Chintamani. It's touchstone. Each speck of dust. Every tree is a Kalpavriksha, every cow is a Kamadenu. Try to imagine, that's pretty Aishwaric. And on top of that, none of the inhabitants of Vrindavan want anything from any of those sources of Aishwarya. It's not that the Brajavas are thinking, oh, this tree is a Kalpavriksha, I can ask so many things to this tree. The only thing about getting fruits and roots and leaves to decorate Krishna, to offer Krishna, And they don't even need to ask that to the trees. The trees are already inclining themselves, bending down to facilitate that. That's how it works. But in principle, the tree is a kalpavriksha. Although in an operative level, nobody notices that because there's no interaction as such of, okay, this is a kal there's no awareness. This is a kalpavriksha. Let's request all this stuff. We can ask whatever we want. And so on and so forth. In the same way, the cows being Kamadhenu, the dust being Chintamani. So full Aishwarya in Vrindavan, and full intimacy, and full familiarity, full. You can live with God as a family member, or God will be your family member. That's basically. Today I was seeing a talk by Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and he was mentioning that. That's our attainment, no? Be as a family member with the divine, a family setting, intimate setting, at home. So that's Naralila, and that's why all things considered, Naralila is considered the highest lila, at least from our perspective. Krishnaraya Tikkakila Sarva Uttama Naralila, Naravaputan Harasvarup. In this Naralila, which is the highest of all, Sarva Uttam, God appears in his ultimate surup, in his ultimate form identity, that comes in Naralila. So Naralila is fully human and fully divine, but we choose to, in this case, emphasize fully human, because many times we forget to lay proper emphasis on that in the Lila, and also lay proper emphasis on that in our own case. Sometimes we forget to be human, and we become a little bit obsessed with becoming divine, transcendental, spiritual, advanced, strict, whatever you use, you name it. But the word human kind of disappears. So, regarding your question, the fact that our goal is Naralila, the fact that our aspiration is fully human, includes full humanity, directly, not indirectly, but directly tells us you should be fully human as well. There's no need to discard your humanity, but just try to express your humanity in the context of your spirituality. Humanity has to contextualize spirituality. Spirituality has to contextualize humanity. The two of them have to put each other in place and nourish each other. There's no need to just embrace one, do away with the other. So if our goal is fully human, I'm expected to attain full humanity to access that goal. And that entering and that accessing becomes here and now, be begins here and now, sorry. So the more we as sadhakas, as practitioners, try to be human, try to spiritualize our humanity, the more we will become closer and closer to our goal. So in that connection, and this is mentioned in many sections of Shastra, and I provided some quotes in my book. I remember one of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur from a purport from the Srimad Bhagavatam Rasa Lila, and he will mention that that a devotee at one point becomes fully spiritualized, all his body, all his mind, all his psyche. And then another section from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, when Rupa Goswami is explaining Bhava Bhakti, and he mentions how Bhava Bhakti implies a descent of Bhava into the life of a devotee. If you want to speak in some way, descent, and I'm making some sign from up to down somehow or other. So I descend of that energy, Nitya Siddhasya Bhavasya, like the definition of sadhana bhakti by Rupa Goswami. So Bhava Bhakti enters and spiritualizes the mind of a devotee. Like implying, and the implication is, if a devotee has a certain mindset, a certain psychology, a certain identity out of our swabhava or our acquired nature, because all of us have a psychological identity now, and we have our spiritual identity as Atma, and we have our potential identity in the context of bhakti. So we can speak in all these terms. So our acquired identity. I'm sorry, I'm eating a candy for my throat, so sometimes it may get in my way of speaking. Our swabha, or our nature, acquired identity. Yes, it's temporary. It's a result of previous actions. It's not part of the intrinsic nature, so to say, of the soul. But in bhakti, the consideration is the following. If in this particular situation, I'm an atma, and as an atma, I have been traveling in samsara for anadi lifetimes, and this particular lifetime, I have a particular acquired swabhava, which makes me have a certain personality trait, and so on and so forth. That's it. But if it's in this lifetime I practice bhakti deeply, intensely, and let's say I reach my goal, hypothetically, in terms of arriving to the stage of divine love, hypothetically, I'm far from that. So the rays of bhakti, the descent of bhakti, the influence of bhakti in the form of bhava, prema, eventually will spiritualize my whole being. Not only this, the physical body becomes spiritualized, but the mind, the psyche, becomes surcharged with bhakti samskars, with devotional impressions. So the point there is that the nature that we had at that point as a sadhak, as a practitioner, the particular personality that we had, in combination, of course, with the ingress of bhakti, and how that also will, in one sense, affect our personality. In one sense, before being devotee, we had a certain personality. After being devotee, that same personality stays, but also there are changes in how we think and behave and so on. So in one sense, it changes, and in other sense, it doesn't change. So the point is, after bhakti enters and spiritualizes all that sense of identity, that sense of identity will accompany us eternally. Why not? Because it's a result of bhakti. Now, of course, it's combined with our material samskaras, but now fully spiritualized. So that speaks about the power of bhakti, how much bhakti can enter into a, let's say, an acquired nature result of that was a result of karma, enter there, create its effect, its spiritualization, and make that fit to be offered in service eternally. And even in that case, I always give the example, and I always remember one particular devotee in this connection. Let's say that devotee, before starting bhakti in this lifetime, was a little, I don't know, grumpy. Grumpy? You understand the word grumpy? The person gets angry a little bit. It's a little bit like, not nothing violent, nothing extreme, but that's part of his personality. But then bhakti comes, enters, and the devotee surrenders and sincerely gives himself fully, and eventually becomes a super advanced practitioner, very saintly, very pure, very beautiful, but still grumpy. But that grumpiness is playing itself out now in the context of the saintliness of that person. So that grumpiness now becomes an ornament to his personality. It's not playing itself in the same way, but some remnant of that remains, but just in the exact measure and form for it to be an ornament now, for it to create some like endearing attitude toward that person. Because that little grumpiness now comes in the context of all this glorious character, which is a result of bhakti. So it adds to the equation. Not like the famous example of Prabhupada. No. We have so many zeros, no value, no matter you have one zero, 3 million zeros, you add the number one at the beginning of the zero. Everything else that was a zero now acquires another value. So this is something like that. Now, we may have had some things that were zero without bhakti, but you add bhakti to the equation, and you don't need to reject the zeros. Actually, in one sense, you need to keep the zeros, and the value increases, so to say. So bhakti is very practical in that sense. We don't need to reject anything, as we always say. We just need to add the one, and to keep the one in its proper place. Don't put the one after the zeros because the value will change. You will have 0.00001%. Put the one in the beginning and you become millionaire, so to say. So because that's also, we can say, no, I included Krishna in my life. He's the one. Yeah, but where is the one? It's in the beginning or it's in the middle or it's at the end? No. So as long as you keep it in post number two, number one, in the top one of the list, all the zeros will, how to say, will express themselves in their proper glory. So that will be basically the idea. One can back, actually it speaks about the glory and power of bhakti. So it can enter and purify everything. Prabhupada will give the example of the sun many times. And Prem, divine love, is compared to the sun by Rupa Goswami. No? He describes Bhava Bhakti as Prema Suryamsu Samyabhak. No? He says Bhava is a ray of the sun of Prem. So Prem is like the sun. And when the sun comes, Prabhupada will say, its light purifies everything. Even substances that are impure by nature becomes purified by the sun. So in that sense, we could say bhakti comes, the full sun of bhakti comes, and we don't need to discard our personality. But that personality, in conjunction with bhakti, will become our ultimate identity. So that's basically, of course, I'm talking in general. We can become even more specific and we could say, okay, that applies to your identity as a sadhaka in Nityanavadvip. That's an option. But what about your identity in Golok Vrindavan? And I wouldn't say it's entirely different and you are absolutely bipolar or something like that. That's another conversation, of course. We are talking, making the point in general. Just the ultra specifics of all that, probably we may not be able to figure everything out from here now with our head, so to say. We have to just go deeper in bhajan and practice and again, have faith by experience that gradually all the things will like feed into place gradually, naturally.
I think the important thing, Maharaj, that about this is that we don't want to reject this life. We don't want to just jump over. We have to work with it. That it's important to use this life and make the most of it, because in the end, it matters. It matters.
We have
that with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. We have Anu Tamchitra raising her hand, so we can continue with her question or comment, whatever.
I think Madhav Prabhu raised first.
You're up here first in the row, so.
Oh, okay.
We will go to both, so no problem.
Okay, Maharaj. So I'll ask my question. So Maharaj, in this ninth chapter in Bhagavad Gita, verse 30th, Krishna says that even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination.
Yes.
However, this sort of seems to contradict with the pastime of Mahaprabhu with Chota Haridas, where so it almost went to the point of, in one sense, abandonment of him, where he had to commit suicide as a form of atonement for having some lusty desires towards a person. So I'm sort of wondering how, like, Mahaprabhu is not different from Krishna. It's like his words, in one sense, seem to contradict actions. So how do we understand this, Maharaj?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. And yeah, very intelligently put. I appreciate your desire to understand things properly without contradiction. And that's an important exercise that we need to engage in. Not that if something doesn't make sense, like, okay, I'll skip that because it's problematic and let's just remain more general because that will be messy and complicated. But no, we need to enter into those places and we need to, of course, to have a place for asking those questions and the question to be heard and validated and hopefully answered properly as well. And that's how our faith gets nourished, basically. Well, like we can understand what's the meaning of these statements, how the contradiction can be resolved, and how the faith can grow onto another level, integrating the reconciled puzzle, so to say. So, okay, you are invoking two things here. One says you have, quote, the most controversial verse of the Bhagavad Gita. And on another side, you have maybe quoted the most controversial pastime in Gaur Lila. And you have put those together. So now we have double topmost controversy. So I appreciate you have put me way in a controversial like now, but I'm okay. I'm accustomed to that. So how to integrate these two things? So the verse you quoted from the Gita, we have talked about that many times from different perspectives. So Krishna is declaring, as you properly mentioned, that person, despite being of very bad behavior, if someone is sincerely determined in surrendering unto me, Krishna says, I consider that person sadhu, because that person is properly situated in his, her one-pointedness determination, so to say. No, I want to give myself, I want to surrender, despite the mess that I am at present. Krishna says, already in principle, that person is a sadhu. So that's the meaning of sadhu. That's the point I have been like to make, I'd like to make recently. Because sometimes we say sadhu and we imagine like topmost, most advanced person on planet there. That's only a sadhu, saintly, enlightened. No, no. You can be a mess, but a sincere mess, and you're a sadhu. Not to abuse that and okay, I can be a mess. No, no, that's you are not being sincere if you say that. So that's one side. And the other side, you have this Lila you are quoting from Gaur Lila, where Chotahari does, yeah, it seems a very exaggerated overreaction from Mahaprabhu, right? It may seem to some. Because as we know, Chotahari Das was begging rice, for not for him even, and he accepted rice from Madhavi Devi. So Madhavi Devi she was an elder Vaishnavi, very elder, and very saintly. I mean, she was one of the four, only four people with whom Mahaprabhu will discuss Rasakata, or the most intimate subject matters. Ravananda Roy, Swarup Damodar, Sikhi Mahiti, and Madhavi Devi. So you can imagine, I mean, Madhavi Devi was not like a, how to say, like a sensual, tempting young lady who wanted to make young monks fall from their vows or stuff like that, whatever the case. She was very elder, very saintly, one of Mahaprabhu's most intimate associates, and Chotahari Das was received some grains of rice from her in begging. So it's not that he was like cocked with her in a very compromised situation, anything like that. He was just accepting some rice. And Mahaprabhu rejected him for that. He forbid him to be in his close association. No, he was a singer in Mahaprabhu's group. So he was like banished from that. And eventually, as we know, it is hinted somehow that he killed himself as a way of trying to atone for his sin. So yeah, I know that for many devotees, this is not the first time that, even if you don't ask me with the Bhagavad Gita verse, just the Leela in itself, it may sound for some like very, why Mahaprabhu reacted like that and why Chotahari Das had to kill himself. Are we promoting suicide? Well, another layer of conversation. And that also I'll go that in a while, in a moment. So, and of course you are putting these two things together and asking, okay, but Krishna in the Gita is saying, I mean, you can fail miserably, durachar, you can really be a very bad behavior, but if you're sincere, you are a sadhu. So why here, Chotohari does engage in a, you could say in no fault whatsoever, or even if you want to see that as a fault, slight fault. I mean, he was a renounced person himself, so one could say, okay, a renounced person shouldn't have received grains from a lady according to the social criterion of the time. Okay, but it seems like, again, Mahaprabhu's reaction was not so much as you mentioned in line with this verse of the Gita. So what to do with that dilemma? Of course, also in the Gita, Krishna say things like yad yad charati shrestas tata devitaro jana, and so on. Whatever, whatever a great man performs, common people follows. So I'm going to that verse for a second because that's basically the point here, which is Mahaprabhu is a sannyasi in his lila, and there's a relative side, a relative consideration. Rupa Goswami calls this lokavichar. So lokavichar basically means public opinion. So on one level, Mahaprabhu is a sannyasi. On one level, Mahaprabhu says, "Naham vipro yatirva." He says, "I'm not Brahman, Sudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmachari, Grihastha, I'm not a sannyasi." So it's interesting because he is a sannyasi, but he says, "I'm not a sannyasi." Gopi Bhartu Pada Kamala Yor Dasa Dasa Nuda. I'm a servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna, the beloved of the gopis. That's who I am. Like in that context, Mahaprabhu is showing the absolute side, so to say. I'm a servant of Krishna. And he denies the relative side in that verse. I'm not a sannyasi. But on some other moments of his lila, he is emphasizing I am a sannyasi. Now, because of the social repercussions and implications that may be there if he doesn't behave properly as a sannyasi. I mean, the whole purpose of why he became a sannyasi, at least on some level, we can also explain Mahaprabhu's sannyas from the perspective of him tasting Radha Bhava, but that's another conversation. On a more relative level, Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas to be, in one sense, taken more seriously in society. So he could deliver the gift he came to give in a proper way. So he was taking care of that public image on a sannyasi. So he was very strict as a sannyasi, as we know. So the point here is, in the case of Chota Haridas, again, he didn't behave extremely bad. We could say he engaged in a very minor fault, even if you want to see it like that. And Mahaprabhu took a very strong stance with him externally. It's not that internally he rejected Chota Haridas. That's an important point. It's not that really Mahaprabhu was rejecting him, banishing him from his heart, but he took external stance and measure according to how people in society will see my reaction to this situation, to show, and also to show how serious someone who accepts the renounce order should be. Serious in terms of, I mean, yeah, serious. Not only is someone in the renounce order, of course, no, and so many other orders, but sometimes we have seen people becoming accepting sannyas and unfortunately not living up to the mark, and that creates a whole, I don't know, bad image in society and a whole idea of okay, sannyasa, yeah. I've heard devotees telling me like, oh yeah, some devotees accept sannyas. In some groups in the past, people will accept grihastha ashram and eventually accept sannyas. But nowadays, people accept sannyas to enter grihastha ashram after. So you can imagine, no? So, and they are saying that because of something. I mean, they are not just being cynical with bad intention. Maybe they are expressing their pain and their overwhelming after one case after another of of messiness in that sense. So I will say that basically Mahaprabhu is taking a very strong stance. He's not in one sense contradicting the Gita verse. He's Mahavadanya, he's the most merciful of all. So that verse of the Gita applies to him even more than Krishna, if you will. But in that particular Leela, in that particular example, he's taking a like thunderbolt-like stance just to make a clear point, a strong point. Chotahari Das is considered eternal associate of Mahaprabhu. So we have to also see that from a broader perspective. No, he's never banished, he's never without him, he's eternally with him, but he's being used, let's put it that way, to provide a certain lesson for everyone else. No? Like sometimes it is Srila Siddharmaraj will give the example. It's not exactly the same, but he will give the example of Judas in the Bible, in the Christian, the Jesus Leela, so to say. No? And he will say, as generally in a movie, the bad guy has to be the best actor, he will say. So in the same way, in the life of Jesus, his most surrendered disciple was Judas. And he had to do something that nobody else could have done, which is to behave in a certain way that will... Sorry, 1 second. Only Judas could do what he did, which was to betray Jesus. Someone had to do that to highlight Jesus' position and bring him to the ultimate glory, while Judas will be insulted and condemned for eternity. And Judas was willing to do that, to pay the price of being the worst guy of the whole history of humanity. He was willing to do that for the glory of his master. That's how Srila Siddharmaraj explained that. But implying that's not making Judas distant from Christ, but the opposite. So in the same way, we could, on some level, compare this with Chotohari Das saying he's an eternal associate of Mahaprabhu, he's totally close to him, but he's playing a certain role and he's been chastised for that to make a point, then he's killing himself, which again, we are not suggesting suicide here, but somehow according to... He thought, according to the criteria of the time, that was the thing to be done to leave it clear that Mahaprabhu's reputation was totally in place, so to say. Of course, again, he's an eternal associate. So in his case, what does suicide mean? No, he's way beyond that. But the way he behaved took shape according to some sensibilities relative to a time, culture, and place, which is not something of absolute application. And then we hear in Chaitanya Charitamrita that after that, Mahaprabhu will hear the singing of Chotohari Das after he died, quote unquote died. He will hear Chotohari Das singing for him. So he will continue singing and praising and pleasing Mahaprabhu, and he will receive that. So to say, that singing, it's not like, I don't want to hear you sing, you are banished, I told you are banished. No, no, Mahaprabhu never did that. No, so again, this is the point. The whole Leela has a very, in my opinion, a very relative side to it concerning sannyas and public opinion of the time and what is a sannyas is expected and what's the reaction for atonement is expected and so on and so forth. More in social circles according to the expectations of the time. So I wouldn't like take that out of context and try to apply that in an absolute form, because of course that will be completely dysfunctional and contradictory with so many other things like the verse you quoted and so many other things. And for example, that brings me to mind in this connection to show the relativity of that. For example, I remember that we have this the case of Bishnuyang Swami. You may have heard about Bishnuyang Swami. He was a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. Very nice devotee, very nice kirtaniya. Sannyasi, he accepted sannyas very young, like of course most of the sannyasi that accepted sannyas from Prabhupada. And eventually he had some problems with his sannyas. And he asked once to Prabhupada, like, so what should a sannyasi do if he falls from his vows? And this may be controversial again. Prabhupada said he should kill himself. And the point is that eventually Vishnu and Swami killed himself. And when Prabhupada heard that, he started to cry and say, like, he shouldn't have killed himself. And of course, this can sound like, but he say that. But the point is, Prabhupada mentioned that from a general, he was not thinking, okay, he's asking me this because he has a problem. I mean, Prabhupada didn't know he had the problem at the time, anyhow. So he replying from a more general place, and also, I will say, with more consideration of what was said in Shastra, and not so much with how that should take shape in the particular time, place, and circumstance he was in. And when he actually knew, oh, my disciple took my words literally and absolutely, he lamented for that. And I'm sure he, how to say, he never said that again, in the sense of he knew how that may be interpreted and taken in an absolute literal terms. But he was just referring to something similar that happened in Shastra, but never thinking, he's thinking about that. He's about to do that. And because when that happened, he lamented he shouldn't have done that, so to say. No. And there are other examples where other sannyasis, of course, as you may know, disciples of Prabhupada left the sannyas order while Prabhupada was alive. And we, that at least in my knowledge, he never told them, kill yourself. But he tried to encourage them, like, continue. Now continue your practice of Krishna Bhakti, because ultimately the Siddhanta for us, that's another layer of reply. I mean, in Bhakti, there is no atonement, technically speaking. The only atonement is Bhakti, because there is no higher thing than Bhakti. So if I'm practicing Bhakti and I made some mistake in Bhakti, the best thing I can do is to practice Bhakti. If there will be something else to do, that something else will be above Bhakti, but there's nothing above Bhakti. So the best thing to do is to, if I fell, if you want to use that expression, you fell, okay, you stand up by the grace of Bhakti and continue engaging in Bhakti. So that's also an important point, because if not, we may end up in more like, so to say, relativistic or karmakandic consideration. Okay, I did this wrong, so I have to execute this like separate ritual or atonement outside of the context of Bhakti. No, and that's not necessarily the case. I'm speaking in general. Of course, specific situations, some devotee may have done something very, I don't know, heinous, and that person may feel the need of, I will fast for a few days, or I will do some, but all in the context of Bhakti, that there is a place for that also. So that can take different shapes, but my main point is the atonement in Bhakti is Bhakti. Here Bhakti Rasa is commenting, Prabhupada performed the marriage ceremony of his disciple that stepped down from sannyas. Yeah, right. Thank you for that addition. So again, yeah, it's important that we put all the things on the scale and not just take one, like one part of the movie, so to say, one screenshot and not the full picture. So I don't know, does it help, Anuttam Chitra, or still we need some to dig deeper a little bit more?
Yes, Maharaj, for now that helps. I'll also probably churn on what you've said, and if I have any further doubts or clarification, I'll ask you. But for now, that has answered my question, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And one little detail. I know it's difficult, or it may be even impossible for us to fully grasp all the social implications of the things we are talking here in another country, of course. For most of us, another country, not for you, Anuttam Chitra, like India, and 500 years ago, which is another country. India 500 years ago is another country from India now. So it's almost impossible that we can really enter into the sensibilities of the time, the psychology of the time, not to justify anything, but just to make the point that unless you like professionally, so to say, train your mind and make the effort to travel in time and become embedded with the sensibilities of 5 centuries ago, probably we will miss many of these details that need to be in place for fully grasping the situation. I remember I had that experience when I read the book Modern Hindu Personalism. It's like a scholarly study written by Ferdinando Sardella. He's actually a Gaudiya Vaishnav, Pranava Prabhu. And he wrote like his scholarly thesis on the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. It's a very nice book, very interesting, it's scholarly, academic. So and he really does the research of a scholar and travels in times and enters into the time of Calcutta at that time, Puri at that time, and why Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta did what he did, with which consideration in mind to the social climate of the time. And there is so much detail that you need to, how to say, become aware of to really make sense of why he did that. If you just watch it from now, like one, in his case, will be 1 century after, and that's still, why that, why like this? So, but if you take the time to travel back to that specific time, place, circumstance, and that's an effort. That's a tadatmya. No, you have to be empathic. You have to leave your own place and perspective and enter into the world of the other person, into the mind of the other person, and learn to see things from that perspective. So that's tapasya in its own way. So what to speak 500 years ago? I mean, in the last years, in the last century, things have changed so rapidly and quickly that, I mean, so many things have changed. So anyhow, a point that I wanted to make in connection to what I said. Yeah. Thank you. So we have Madhav raising his hand.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, pranams. I hope you're doing with your toothache.
Here we are.
Maharaj.
Yeah.
Last week I asked you a question on email and you asked me to ask it on Ishta Goshti. You said that we should be able to talk deeply about basic topics than talking basic about deep topics, basically about deep topics, like on a surface about deep topics, that we should be able to dive deeper into basic topics than just surfacing upon deep topics. Can you explain what you mean by that? I just wanted to get that clarified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It's nice because, I mean, of course, I told you to make the question here, one, because I didn't have time at the moment to reply in a written way, but also I thought it's nice to have the conversation with all of us. And before the call, I just was having an exchange with Deva Madhava Prabhu, because we are organizing, I'll be traveling to Michigan in May. So we'll be doing a retreat together. So we were talking about what we will talk about. We were talking about what to talk about in the retreat, you know, which will be the theme or the topic. So I'm giving you the trailer now so you can save your seats and come to Michigan. It's not so far from India, just a little bit. Same planet, basically. So yeah, basically we decided to talk basically about this. Actually, he himself told me that. He suggested that without knowing your question or anything. He said, yeah, Maharaj, it will be nice to talk about like reimagining bhakti and redefining these basic things, like we are not this body or this or that, with new eyes, no? Like with depth, with like going beyond the official meanings and being in this spirit of students forever and rediscovering what all these so-called basic things can mean. In depth and breadth and potential. So somehow I was reminded of this particular idea, which is actually not mine. This comes from Srila Siddhar Maharaj. So I'm sorry if you heard that from me and I didn't quote the source, but the situation is as follows. Srila Siddhar Maharaj was once sharing Harikatha, and Srila Siddhar Maharaj generally wouldn't speak so much about deep topics. He will speak about, again, basic topic in the deepest possible way, which in itself is is incredible. It's an epiphany. He will just take something that you will think, oh yeah, I know about that topic, but he will like unfold and unpack and take you on a total new journey for you to conclude thinking, wow, I thought I knew about that, but now I realize I was just grasping the surface of the whole thing. No, he took me on a trip to the depths of the ocean. So he wouldn't talk about that so much, about deep topics. I mean, he could talk about deep topics, but generally that was not his policy, so to say. He was very much a follower of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta in this spirit of, I won't talk about deep topics publicly, cheaply. No, I want to make, in honor to those deep topics, I won't talk about them. No? Like Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say, I've been talking 80% about what Krishna consciousness is not. No? Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta is famous for saying that. No, most of my time I spent about clarifying potential misreadings of the whole thing. Not because that was his favorite theme, but just he saw that's a necessity. So I'll do that. I mean, as we know, before his preaching campaign, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will chant Sato Koti Nam. He engaged in that yagmya, which is chanting 1 billion names, which basically means chanting 122 rounds for 10 years, 3 lakhs for a decade. So my point is, he had a taste for an inner life of bhajan. He could be that driving in that world for turn. So he woke up from that to talk mostly about what he was doing is not, for those who didn't have an idea about that. So you can try to imagine the sacrifice he was doing, the dedication for us, you know, the love he had for leaving his bhajan kutir that he could inhabit totally deeply there forever, and just starting with the basic. This is not that. This is not as you think. No, that's not the case. That's a misreading. That's misunderstanding. And trying to set a clear foundation of what actual bhakti is. So Srila Siddhar Maharaj followed that very loyalty. He will quote always this famous line, Pujala Raga Pata Gaurava Bhange Matala Haryana Vishayarange, that Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will mention, where he mentions, in honor, because we honor the Raga Mark, the path of Raga Nuga Bhakti, of the spontaneous devotion that the Brajavasis personified, we will worship that path from the distance. It's not that we will worship that with Gaurav, with certain reverence. We will put our heads. It's not that we worship with reverence Krishna. We worship with reverence the love of the Brajavasis that we want to attain. But because we want to attain, instead of rushing there, we'll worship that with reverence. We will properly appreciate what that is. And we will clearly understand what that is not. All that in the context of showing our respect for that ideal that we passionately will like to pursue. But passionately doesn't mean rushing. No? Srila Siddhar Maharaj is famous for saying, fools rush where angels fear to tread. That's one of his mottos. So he will say, become an angel. No, don't rush. So that's another way of saying, don't engage with higher topics superficially. It's more safe, more secure to remain in the basics, but go deep into that. So basically the situation was that Srila Siddhar Maharaj was speaking about something basic in a non-basic way. But the devotee was like, new devotee was hearing Srila Siddhar Maharaj and trying to like to imitate him. But he didn't understand. He thought Srila Siddhar Maharaj speaking about very deep topics. So the devotee tried to imitate. So he took a book and he started to, a very high book, and he started to like just do copy paste of that, read and do that superficially without being able to talk about that with realization. It was just theory. And he realized, I'm not able to do this. I'm not able. How is possible for Srila Siddhar Maharaj to always be talking about high topics? And the conclusion was, no, he's not talking about high topics generally. He's talking about basic topics deeply. So we have to develop that capacity. Like Bhakti Sundar Govinda Maharaj will say, he was the personal servant of Srila Siddhar Maharaj and his successor Acharya. He will say, Guru Maharaj, because sometimes Srila Siddhar Maharaj will be seen reading newspaper. Like to become aware of what's going on in the world. No, it's not a scene. But Srila Govinda Maharaj will say, when Guru Maharaj is reading the newspaper, that's like the Bhagavatam for him. No, he's finding Bhagavatam in the newspaper. He's not reading the newspaper as we will read newspaper. And probably we read the Bhagavatam and we read newspaper. That can happen. No. So he will say, when he reads the newspaper, that's like the Bhagavatam for him. So in other words, he has something basic in his hands, newspaper, but he's finding something else. No, he's reaching the depths of those basics. So yeah, that's a very safe position to stay in than try just to rush and deal with very high, deep, esoteric topics in which we don't have realization for. That's the main thing. I mean, you should, and we talked about that also. I remember Madhav in one private message we had, like we shouldn't be preaching or talking to others about things that we have no realization of. That doesn't create any impact, real impact. I mean, if I'm talking to you about something that I'm not doing, even what to speak, I remember, I don't know. Like a parent may tell a child, do what I say, but not what I do, or something like that. No? And they are smoking and say, do not smoke. And that doesn't create the desired effect. So that's one thing. Do not preach about things that you are doing the opposite, but also do not talk about things that you have not realized. Of course, there are unlimited levels of realization, even of the most basic topics. So in that sense, we shouldn't speak about anything. I'm not saying that. But at least we should be honest and sincere enough to really observe where we are and realize what can I talk about and where I can really share some experience, feeling, sharing something genuine alive in me. And not just some official discourse, some professional delivery where I can impact people intellectually, curiously. But there is no change of heart because it's not coming from my heart. So it won't touch the other person's heart. It's just going from brain to brain, probably. And why I'm doing that? Also, that's another layer of inquiry. I'm doing that because I want to impress others. I want them to be like thinking that I'm super whatever, super scholar, super advanced. I want to create a false image because I have a very poor image of myself. So I need everyone else to think that I am more than what I am not. Because many times this happens. Not always, but sometimes externally it seems, wow, you're talking about such an esoteric topic. On the surface, that's the reality. Wow, super esoteric kata. But beyond the surface, there is someone with low self-esteem that needs to show himself to the public as a super knowledgeable and advanced person. And probably all of us on some level or another may be struggling with something of that unconsciously. No, it's not that it's black and white. Who is free from that? Let's be honest. Many times we try to create a false impression of ourselves in the environment, in our social circle, because still we have not fully accepted Krishna's loving me unconditionally. So I don't need to impress anyone. I'm already fully loved and accepted. Still, we have not fully realized that. So we need to create a false facade, a facade of ourselves to others. So I'm being loved and I'm being accepted and I'm being praised and followed and glorified for what I'm giving the impression that I am. But there's no need of that, technically speaking. Again, from that to realization, it's another thing. But so yeah, it's safer. It's safer to talk about the things that you have some realization and experience and continue going deeper into those things. For me, that's the safest way to reach the higher shores, so to say. I mean, it's not that you are limited to always talk about that. But if you want to talk about higher topics, in a relishable, really relishable way, impactful way, realized way, sincere way. The best thing is in the words, and sorry, I'm referring over and over to Srila Siddhar Maharaj today, not only today, but he will say, try to not rush into the higher quarters, try to pull yourself back honestly, and you will be thrown by force into those higher quarters eventually. It's not that you are trying to do it yourself, but it has to come from above. When it comes from above, that's natural, that's real. When you are called to do that, that's natural, that's real. Don't try to like to position yourself, so to say, by your own initiative. No? By your own initiative, try to be humble, try to serve, try to go deeper into the basics. And if Krishna wants you to go on to some, in this case, higher topics, he will make that clear to you. He will create the inspiration and the circumstances that will be enough clear for you to do to say, yes, okay, this is Krishna's will. I'm taking that step. Or like, I don't know, so many other circumstances in life. Like if someone ends up serving in the capacity of guru, that should be something that, okay, I will decide that. No, like, okay, I want to be a guru, so I'm a guru. It doesn't work like that. No, I think I should be a guru, so I will be a guru. I will announce it today online for those who would like to be my prospective candidates. No, it doesn't work like that. It has to come from above, whether your own guru is requesting you to do that, some other sadhus are requesting to you that, some other prospective candidates are requesting you to do that, and after prayer, Krishna confirms that. I mean, there has to be some higher agency coming. Am I making that clear enough? But want to take those steps, which are risky steps, and be safe, and make those steps sustainable, basically. So many other topics in that connection, of course. But the whole spirit is that like, don't be impatient, basically. Don't feel like the rush to, I need to go higher, I need to read this, I need to go whatever, I need to speak about this, I need to hear about how much what already came to you, how much advantage you have taken of that, how much deeper you can go in what you already have. The safe formula is, you already have the name, you already have Sangha, you already have Shastra, you already have so many things. The question is, I'm doing all that I can to go deeper into those things, or I am not, and I'm looking for higher things as an excuse for not going deeper into the things that already are with me, basically. Do you follow my point? Because that can happen. And the going to higher topics is just evasiveness, spiritual bypassing. We call that sometimes sahaja. That's another way of putting that. Sahaja means easy goer. I want it easy, so to say. So I don't want to go deeper into the basics. I want just to be superficial in the highest and convince myself that I'm very advanced because I only talk and hear super esoteric topics. But what capacity do I have to process that, to live that? How much I'm walking my talk? So again, this is not a crusade against higher topics. No, that's exactly the opposite. It's a proper reverence and appreciation of that higher realities, and a promotion of honesty and integrity and authenticity to really ascertain your adhikar with full transparency. Where are you now? And what you need to work today? I don't know. I'm not saying where you are now, but we should ask where I am now. Which are the things that I need to deal with today? And is there anything that I'm doing an evasive device for that? I'm trying to escape the confrontation of my daily reality. I'm trying to bypass embracing my shadow, dealing with my subconscious, or facing my anarthas, use the word you want, in the name of, let's talk about Gita Govinda and Krishna Bhavanamrita and Govinda Lilamrita, and let's just think about the Ashtakaliya Lila. But still in my daily relationships and example, I'm fairly dysfunctional and unhealed, unwhole. So again, at the end of the day, it's a matter of personal integrity and sincerity. No, we cannot just control everyone else's life. So it's at the end of the day, it's between you and your pillow, as I like to say. Now, when you go to sleep at night, what's in your consciousness? Now, we have to have this inventory, so to say, integrity inventory. I'm cheating myself in the name of bhakti. I'm trying to cheat myself, to cheat others, to cheat Krishna. Or I'm trying to be as honest as I can, and I'm okay with that. And I don't have the need, the pressure to be a superhero, to impress my environment. Because if I have all that stuff, at the end of the day, it speaks back about my own sense of inadequacy and probably a few things that I need to work on a personal level. And that's going deep into the basics. Again, that's another way of speaking about that. Some of us may need to heal emotionally, psychologically. And in one sense, that's basic in comparison to the Rasa Lila. But you can go so deep into that, because sometimes we have deep wounds that need to be addressed, because if not, they get in the way of our practice. So that's a way of saying go deep into your basics. In connection to bhakti, in the context of eventually being an integrated being that can speak about Vrindavan from a realistic perspective. And that's why, again, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta took the stance he took. That's why Mahaprabhu took the stance he took. I mean, Mahaprabhu, again, talk about these things with four people. And he had pretty much many associates and pretty much qualified, I will say. But he made the point, this is not to be given, to make a public show of this. And most of his life, he will emphasize Sankirtan and he will preach the basics, but he will go deep into his chanting and deep into the basics. And eventually all that took him to Gambira at the end. He didn't enter Gambira at day one of his Lila. He saved that for his anti-Lila. That's his anti-Lila. Nirjan Bhajan, solitary Bhajan in the cave, so to say. Relishing, yes, Gita Govinda and Chandidas and Vidyapati and all these romantic authors. But before that, there is a preparation ground, so to say. You have to follow all the sequence. Mahaprabhu is Krishna in his Acharya Lila. So it's God himself teaching us by example what to do, when to do, how to do. So we cannot just skip that and create our own sequence. I mean, you can do it, but you judge the tree by its fruit at the end of the day. So yeah. That will be a little bit in relation to your question, Madhav, on the importance of going deep into the basics, not taking Krishna consciousness for granted, as I mentioned in radical personalism, not thinking that I already figure out what it means, all these foundational teachings, and understanding the unlimited nature of the message, as basic as it may be, you know? So showing that willingness to go deeper into what's already with us. Because if not, we are escaping depth, basically. No. You won't become deeper by going to deep topics. You will become deeper by going deeper into what you already have. And that takes you immediately to the other topics. Because the other topics are found the deeper you go into the basic topics. They're not like a different ocean, so to say. So we have to just try to go as deep as we can with what we have today, with our capacities, with the grace that knock on our door. Try to go a little bit more deeper than yesterday. Not also go get neurotic. Have to go super deeper like ever before today, as much as you can today in a sustainable way. That's it. And that will warrant that tomorrow you will be fit for it. Yet a deeper dive, so to say. And the day after tomorrow, a deeper dive. And that's how you make progress. And there's no end to the depth of that ocean. It's ever evolving. So we will be always going deeper on a daily basis for eternity. So that's it. It's just making the deeper dive sustainable on a daily basis instead of just trying to make a quantum leap from one day to another. It doesn't work like that. Okay, some thoughts in that connection?
Thank you so much, Maharaj. That was such a that balanced out.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. Bhakti Rasa is mentioning, is going deeper also meant by going through? Yeah, of course. That's a classical psychological advice that they will say, which is basically the going forward is by going through. So yeah, we need to go through things. And sometimes, again, going through some things will be messy, will be embarrassing to our ego. But that's also another way of saying go deep into the basics. No, because sometimes we have to confront certain situations in our inner self that are embarrassing for our ego, again, for our traumatized being. We don't want to see that. We don't want to confront that. We don't want to suffer. No, sometimes we need to go through some internal things that are painful, not because we are masochists. Okay, let's suffer as much as we can, but because we need to go through certain pain. So we get rid of a certain pain, but we learn to integrate certain situations. So that's also a way of speaking about this, yeah, going through. Because sometimes we have talked about that for years now. because sometimes we hear this other idea, let's move forward. But the moving forward is by going through. There's no moving forward without going through. Moving forward without going through is probably moving backwards. It's evasiveness. It's just like, again, moving forward is rushing onto something higher, creating a superficial landscape to run, to escape, instead of entering the tunnel, so to say. No? So let's create like a circus and let's move forward. Let's go there. There's entertainment there. Let's have fun. Instead of, no, we have to enter that tunnel that we are not sure if there is light at the end. There is light at the end, but maybe when you enter, you don't see the light. You just see like, this is dark. And you have to find sometimes you will find the exit in darkness. So to say, I'm reading another book, among other books that I'm reading. Let's share my reading list today. I have been reading this very small book, very nice, Celebrating Krishna by Sri Vatsa Goswamiji. It's a very beautiful book. But I was not referring to that book. I'm referring to this one. I'm reading another book, which is called Healing the Shame That Binds You by John Bradshaw. Interesting compliment. Recommended one. And then he mentions a very, very good example. I mean, I can read it. Why not? But I have to find it first. Oh, here it is. Maybe we can conclude with this. I'll read a few paragraphs, which is a parable. A parable, which is the prisoner in the dark cave. Mm-hmm. Sharing my weekly reading with you. So this tastes like this. And this is not a famous Greek parable of the cave. This is another one. There once was a man who was sentenced to die. He was blindfolded and put in a pitch dark cave. The cave was 100 yards by 100 yards. He was told that there was a way out of the cave, and if he could find it, he was a free man. After a rock was secured at the entrance of the cave, the prisoner was allowed to take his blindfold off and roam freely in the darkness. He was to be fed only bread and water for the first 30 days and nothing thereafter. The bread and water were lowered from a small hole in the roof at the south end of the cave. The ceiling was about 18 feet high. The opening was about 1 foot in diameter. The prisoner could see a faint light up above, but no light came into the cave. As the prisoner roamed and crawled around the cave, he bumped into rocks. Some were rather large. He thought that if he could build a mound of rocks and dirt that was high enough, he could reach the opening and enlarge it enough to crawl through and escape. Since he was 5 feet nine, whatever, I don't remember the measurements in English, and his reach was another 2 feet, the mound had to be at least 10 feet high. So the prisoner spent his waking hours picking up rocks and digging up dirt. At the end of 2 weeks, he had built a mound of about 6 feet. He thought that if he could duplicate that in the next 2 weeks, he could make it before his food ran out. But as he had already used most of the rocks in the cave, he had to dig harder and harder. He had to do the digging with his bare hands. After a month had passed, the mound was 9.5 feet high, and he could almost reach the opening if he jumped. He was almost exhausted and extremely weak. One day, just as he thought he could touch the opening, he fell. He was simply too weak to get up, and in 2 days he died. His captors came to get his body. They rolled away the huge rock that covered the entrance. As the light flooded into the cave, it illuminated an opening in the wall of the cave about 3 feet in circumference. The opening was the opening to a tunnel which led to the other side of the mountain. This was the passage to freedom the prisoner had been told about. It was in the south wall, directly under the opening in the ceiling. All the prisoner would have to do was crawl about 200 feet and he will have found freedom. He had so completely focused on the opening of light that it never occurred to him to look for freedom in the darkness. Liberation was there all the time, right next to the mound he was building, but it was in the darkness. So that said, I hope you can get the idea what we were talking now. So sometimes again, freedom, what we need to embrace is not necessarily into the light in terms of the higher thing and running in that direction, but sometimes going deep into the basics means looking for what we need into the darkness, going deep into the things that may feel a little bit intimidating, unknown, uncertain, and learning to coexist, as we talked in Radical Personalism, coexist with mystery and all these principles related to which faith is all about. As we also defined, faith is patience with mystery. Be patient with the unfolding of things when they lay out of your control. And try to be courageous. Again, another definition of courage is that courage means to show up when we don't have a control over the outcome. And nonetheless, we show up. We dare to show up. And so all the things are crucial for us to be real devotees, real human beings, real persons living a real life. So some concluding thoughts. We are already past 1 hour and a half, so I think we can close the curtains here today. And we'll see you hopefully next Saturday. I will be in New Mexico, so let's see if I will have time available to join, because I will be just in one retreat and probably at that time, so I'm still not sure, but I will make my best. If not, maybe we can, if not, adjust the timing or the day or something, so we don't skip again another week. But thank you so much to all of you for time, presence, affection, association, questions, sincere engagement. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Ki Jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar Ji Ki Jai, Sri Sri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinath Ji Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Priman Hari Vo, Vancha Kalpataru Vishra, Kripa Sindhu Pya Iva Cha Patitanam Pavane Pya Vaishnavipya Namona. Anantakoti Vaishnavrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Hari.